election. We've been informed that a chairperson has been nominated or identified by the majority party, so we will start proceedings. Also, we have been informed in the name of ATC last night of the new member replacing our former chairperson, Duma Nkosi. So in terms, therefore, we will proceed. And his name is Mr. Chris Machalacha. He will has been formally identified as a member of the PC on Trade and Industry. Therefore...
Sorry, Andre, to interrupt you. Mr. Chris Malamachi is struggling to log in. I don't know what is wrong with the link. All accessories in the chief.
No, it's fine. Thank you. We'll continue with proceedings. We do correct and we so we can. Just in order to proceed, I will do a roll call and I will call the names of the members on the platform. Mrs. Simmons.
Good morning to everyone on the platform. I'm present.
Thank you. Mr. Mbuyani.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning. Good morning, colleagues. I'm present. Thank you.
Mr. Burns Namashi.
Molo Nopala di Namalungu di Kona and Ghost.
Thank you. Mr. Mulder.
Good morning, everybody. I'm present.
Ms. Mutahu.
Good morning, colleagues. I'm present.
Mr. Cuthbert.
Good morning, everyone.
Ms. Mwatsi.
Good morning, everyone. I'm present.
As previously indicated, the new member is struggling to join the platform, but we do correct and we can proceed with the election of the chairperson. In terms of Rule 158 of the NA, we are calling for the names for members or for the person to be nominated as chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry. May I have a nomination? I have the hand of Mr. Mbuyani.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I rise to nominate the name of Honorable
Recording in progress.
Judy Hemmings to be the chair of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. We have Mr. Mbuyani nominated Ms. Judy Hemmings as chairperson. May I have a seconder for that, Ms. Mutahu?
Thanks, Chair. I second the nomination of Honorable Judy Hemmings.
We have a second, Ms. Mutahun, second the nomination of Ms. Mbuyani for Ms. Judy Hemmings as Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry. Are there any other nominations? There being no other nominations, I declare Ms. Judy Hemmings duly elected as Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee of Trade and Industry and request that she take the chair and start proceedings. Thank you.
Good morning, Committee Secretary. Thank you very much for the nomination for the position of Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry, and I hope that I will be able to, I will work very hard to do justice to this position. I know I have very big shoes to fill, and I will do my best. Thank you very much. Can we ask that the agenda be flighted?
We have the hands of Mr. Cuthbert and Ms. Mutahu up, Chair. I'm not just sure if that was anything prior to the agenda.
Thank you, Mr. Cuthbert. You're recognized.
Thank you, Chairperson, or newly elected Chairperson. Congratulations on your election. As a DA, we look forward to working with you, and we hope that your tenure as acting chairperson, the vein in which it continues throughout the rest of the term. I think we've worked together relatively well, and I'd like to see that moving forward. And then just a bit of housekeeping. I did write a letter to you, I think this past Friday, making a request regarding our briefing that we are to have with the SIU chairperson. So I just wanted to know if you could please have a look at that and come back to us with that particular response.
Thank you very much for the well wishes, and we will attend to the correspondence that we have received from you, Honourable Carter. Thank you very much. Honourable Motau.
Thanks, Chair. It's a previous hand.
Okay.
My apologies. Yeah.
Okay. Honourable Mulder.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. From the Freedom Front Plus side, I also wish you well. Congratulations. I think you are a worthy chair, and I'm looking forward to work with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for those well wishes. I look forward to working with all political parties to meet the mandate of this portfolio committee. Thank you very much. We have the agenda in front of us. We now going to look at apologies. Over to you, PC Secretary.
Chairperson, we have the standing apology from Mr. McPherson, who is still ultimate party business, as Mr. Thing is attending another committee meeting, and Ms. Yaku has informed us she is attending a conference, so she won't be able to attend this morning's meeting. Thank you, Chair. Those are the apologies that we have.
Thank you. Duly noted. Our next agenda item is the adoption of the agenda, which will deal with the briefing by DTIC, NRCS and SABS on the Public Protector's Report regarding the illegal conversion of goods carrying Toyota Quantum vans into passenger carrying minibus taxis, and then closing remarks and enclosure. I see the hand of Honourable Burns Namashi. You are noted.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. In fact, when I raised my hand, it was still during the time when honourable members from other political parties were making their congratulatory remarks. And I was also going to say, as the ANC, we don't take it for granted the privilege of being nominated to this position. We feel very much humbled, and we also want to extend the congratulatory gesture and commit our support to your work as our chairperson. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Burns Mamashe. Honourable Moatse.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me also start by congratulating you in the newly elected position. Mbokoto, congratulations to you. And then we hope you are going to work with us very well. We have trust on you. And also let me move for adoption of the agenda as presented. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, members, for those kind words. Obviously, our success is going to depend on our collective effort as members of this portfolio committee. Can I have a seconder for the adoption of the agenda? May we have a seconder, Honourable Burns Namashi?
Honourable Chairperson, I second the adoption of the agenda. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Burns Namashi. So we're looking at the main agenda item. We have the Public Protector's Report that was referred to the committee for its consideration and report. In light of this referral, the committee is required to consider the content of the report and the recommendations made by the Public Protector and to submit a report in this regard. For the purpose of this meeting is to comply with the referral requesting DTIC, NRCS, SABS to provide an update on its action plans to implement the remedial action set up by the public protector as reflected in the report. And we hope that by the end of our deliberations, after the presentations and engagement by portfolio committee members, that we will have achieved that aim. So over to the person leading from the department. I think it's the acting COO, Ms. Matamela. Over to you.
Thanks very much, Honorable Chair. It's Stephen Hannibal here. Good morning
thank
to you,
you.
Honorable
Welcome.
Chair. Thank you so much. Good morning to you and all the honourable members on the platform. Chairperson, I'm the acting DDG in the Industrial Competitiveness and Growth Branch, under which the Technical Infrastructure Institutions fall. So with your permission, Chair, I'll just make a very brief introductory remark and introduce the members of the team that will be undertaking the presentations. And from the DTIC side, it will be Dr. Chenge Damana. With your permission, I'll ask him to take the committee through the DTIC's presentation. He's joined by Ms. Anna-Marie Lotter and Mr. Amos Mbele, also from the technical infrastructure team. They are our technical infrastructure experts in the department. And then from the SAB, it's the lead administrator, Ms. Jody Scott. And from the NRCS, it's Mr. Edward Mamadise. So Chair, as you've indicated, the presentations that the committee will be receiving this morning will be firstly just to sketch a little bit the legal mandate of the DTIC and its institutions in this particular matter, and then to provide a progress report on what action has been taken in response to the public protector's report. Chair, if you are comfortable, I would then request that we hand over to Dr. Chenge Damana to provide the DTIC presentation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hannibal. Over to you, Dr. Damana.
Good morning, members. Thank you very much for giving us a chance to come and explain. I'm going to run through my presentation very quickly because I think my colleagues from the entities will have a lot more to add, and in the interest of time, I see your time seems to be limited. Can I please get the presentation on the being shared?
Can we check who's sharing the presentation, please, Secretary?
Tolo is sharing the presentation. She may just, I think she had the wrong presentation on. She's just checking to ensure that she has the right one, Chair.
That's fine. Thank you.
Okay, there we are. Thank you very much. Can we immediately move to slide 3? As members know, this is really the work of the department, which involves localization, exports, investments, and industrial competitiveness. I think of importance here is just that the NRCS and the SABS are contributing to this work, especially when it comes to industrial competitiveness, where quality falls. But however, quality of products is also required in terms of localization, exported products, and the ability to do this conformity assessment, testing, inspection, etc. is something that investors also require because it helps them to export and sell their products in the market. So before they come here, they need to know that we can do that. which helps. Can we go to the next one? So in terms of the NRCS and the SABS, we know that they report to us. Some of the work that they do is actually delegated by policy owning department, and we know that in delegation the owner still retains a whole lot of responsibility. So as the public protector has indicated, and I think that's the reason we are here, there's room for improvement, so we will say something about that. Thank you. Let's go to the next one. So the owner of the policy when it comes to the safety of vehicles is the National Department of Transport, and they use the National Road Traffic Act. Some of the work has been delegated, but in the terms of the NRCS, the NRCS was appointed as the inspectorate, so as the inspector for manufacturers, importers, and builders of vehicles. The NRCS, in turn, has they use what we call compulsory specifications, which are compulsory standards that everybody has to adhere to in order to actually implement the work that the Department of Transport wants done, and also other work in the automotive space. The SABS, we know they develop standards, and once those standards are referenced in regulation or legislation, they become mandatory, and the NRCS call those standards that have become mandatory, they call them compulsory specifications. I think we are aware of that. And we are aware that the SABS is one of the test houses in the country, so they are one of the conformity assessment providers. And the work done there normally is done under a contractual arrangement. So the client will say what they want tested exactly, and then sign off on that. So you won't expect the SABS to do more or to do less. Can we go on the next one, please? So in the context of the vehicle conventions, I think a silent point is that the public protector dealt with how a process of retrofitting was performed. However, vehicles were already illegally converted way back. So they were, it's said in the report, 2,353 vehicles that were known to have been converted illegally, these vehicles then were, it was a policy decision was taken that instead of taking them off the road, the best way will be to retrofit them. But as we now know, only about 350 actually went to be retrofitted. So this is what the report dealt with, but the findings seems to be throughout the they don't really take into account anymore the 350 compared to the rest of the set. And also it is permitted for people to convert vehicles. We say it's illegal when a vehicle is then put on the road without the necessary approval process that has been basically delegated for the NRCS to do. So the NRCS is bypassed, and then the owner or the company doing the conversion goes straight to the Department of Transport, and they get licensed without the necessary paperwork from the NRCS. Can we go to the next one, please? In this slide, I think the most important points are the two bullet points at the beginning. The public protector found that there were gaps in terms of illegally converted vehicles, that the information, if a vehicle was sold initially or produced initially as a three-seater panel van, because it bypasses the NRCS once converted, it doesn't go back to the NRCS, then it's possible for it to be registered at the Department of Transport Registering Authority as a 16-seater. So you go from a panel van then to a minibus, and the DOT agreed that there is a possibility that their frontline staff at the licensing offices are altering the information on the eNATI system. So fraudulent activities are happening at that point. And so a solution, I would think that recommendations that come from committees should actually look at how do we close that gap, because we know, and this is not contested, that there is a problem there. The third bullet point talks to the fact that the public protector, unfortunately, explain it as if it's inherent in the NRCS legislation that they are an inspector for MIB, which are the manufacturers, importers, and builders of vehicles. But that can't be correct, because we know they were appointed by the owning department. So I think that is problematic. And actually, the department tried to clear that by stating that law enforcement are the people who are supposed to remove vehicles from the roads, and that competency lies with their own entity, the Road Traffic Management Corporation, RTMC, the provinces and the municipalities. So I think the NRCS will explain a lot more in detail in that regard. So I think this misunderstanding is a problem. The SABS, I think the SABS will explain. I think I have already said that they work under contract. Let's go to the next one, please. So because it's misunderstood what the NRCS does, it seems as if the RTMC, this Road Traffic Management Corporation, a very big body, is actually a small unit in the NRCS, because the work that they do then doesn't find, is not highlighted in the report. There are no findings, and there are no remedial action. Well, we are not sure whether that means that they were working as well as they could, but we know that vehicles that they could have removed are still in the road even today. Thank you. The next one. So in terms of the remedial action for the Department of Trade and Industry, it says that the minister should harness and foster good, effective, and efficient working relations between the NRS and the SABS. And I think that's the totality of the remedial action for the department. I think it should be noted that this remedial action is not based on any findings against the department as such. There's always room for improvement, so we don't dispute that we can improve. Let's go to the next one. So with this report, when the NRCS, SABS, and ourselves received it, we realized that there were quite a number of errors and misunderstanding in the report that could be corrected. But unfortunately, the only way to correct is to go to court. So the entities asked the department to take the public protector to court, and the department said no, they can't do that, because we need collegial working relations, and we also need cooperative governance. So it's not ideal for entities of the same government taking each other to court. We should rather address whatever we can in the report. So in that regard, then the the department and the entities sat together and said the work between the NRCS and the SABS is complementary, and they have always worked closely together. But I think what perhaps was lacking was a structured agreement. So we agreed on a memorandum of agreement, and then we also agreed on a memorandum of agreement between the NRCS and the Department of Transport. So NRCS and the SABS have a memorandum of agreement, as well as Transport and NRCS. In addition, we have discussed and agreed that where work is delegated to the NRCS, that before sign-off of whatever is being delegated to the NRCS between the department and NRCS, that the Department of Trade and Industry needs to be involved so that it can be taken through our own departmental legal services. Further, in quarterly reports of the entities, we have asked that the entities address any findings, whatever they can do. We know that the reports have challenges, but as I said, there's always room to improve, and we know that this problem is quite serious. So they have to tell us on a quarterly basis when they report to us what they have done, on what they are planning to do, etc., in its own section, so that it's set out clearly. Furthermore, the Department of Transport and the DTIC, the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition now, we do share ideas on a regular basis. We even had a project last year where we were working with the industry together, looking at the fees or levies that are paid for vehicles and vehicle products that are exported, and looking at how best to regulate that. And I also know that we have another strategy, Vehicle 2025, Safer Vehicle 2025, that the NRCS is championing, and transport is also part of the stakeholders. So in conclusion and in hindsight, I think we should have agreed as the department to have the report reviewed and corrected, because the findings that are not correct are leading people who are trying to come up with solutions, like the committees of parliament, to struggle to come with solutions that are relevant and they deal with the problem. Because as we speak, there's still probably 1,700 plus of vehicles that are used as public transport that are converted illegally. But year after year, they get a license disc from the licensing offices, and they are not being pulled off the road, which is not ideal. I think I'll thank you here and stop. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dumana. The next presentation, is it from NRCS?
It's from SABS.
From SABS, okay. Thank you very much. Over to you, Ms. Scholes.
Good morning, Chairperson and honorable members. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present. Chair, while I'm bringing up my presentation, let me just congratulate you on your appointment as Chairperson. Privileged be led by you, and I'm sure you'll do an absolutely fantastic job. So congratulations, Chair. Apologies, I've got a bit of a challenge with my voice, so I'm just trying to find my presentation, and now my computer seems frozen, Chair. Apologies, let me just try again.
Can we check if there's anybody else from your team who can... Okay, there. It started. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Let me just put it on presentation mode. Thank you. So if you don't mind, I'll put off my video feed. I think it may just with the signal. Chairperson, so I'm going to talk through the legislative mandate, the role of SABs within the technical infrastructure institutions, the status of the public protector's report and what's subsequently been done, and then share with you and the committee the factual and legal errors in our view that's contained in the public protector's report. And then there were quite a few questions that the Portfolio Committee on Transport had asked, but the purpose of the presentation is just to talk about the remedial action for SABs the remedial actions contained in the report, and then the response by SABs. Chair, I think Dr. Demane has indicated this is the legislative mandate of the Bureau of Standards. I'm not going to go through it. Suffice it to say that our primary mandate relates to voluntary standards. There's a national standards development process, which is a consensus-driven process. It involves academia, it involves industry, it involves the regulators. We pull these colleagues into a forum, into a technical committee or a subcommittee. There's a formal engagement. They then develop a standard for a particular area. That document is then gazetted. It's in the public domain for around 60 days. We take those comments, we edit, and we then publish a final standard. So that's the standards development process. It's a voluntary process. It's consensus driven, and the end result is a standard that regulators can use in the execution of their mandate. We also do promote quality with respect to commodities, products, and services, and then we render conformity assessment services. That is in effect, we test in the labs and we audit both products and management systems. This is just SABs in the family of technical infrastructure institutions. I've indicated this is our mandate. We've got the NRCS, that's the regulator. SANAS accredits us. So in terms of the work that we perform, both in the labs and in our certification area, they then make sure that we've got the relevant capabilities and competence to do the work that we need to do. And then we've got NAMESA, which underpins all of the testing through calibration. And so this is the technical infrastructure institutions in South Africa. Just a key, I think, in all of these engagements, a key difference between SABs and the NRCS, we focus on voluntary standards. So any company who wants to, you know, check whether their product complies with the particular standard can contact us and we can do both the auditing and then the testing in the labs for them. So it's a voluntary process. The NRCS is the regulator, and they can take one of our standards, they can amend that standard and publish it in a gazette, making it then a compulsory standard or VCA, a compulsory specification. In terms of what was required by the public protector for the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition, we've had to implement an MOU. I think Mr. Mamadisi will talk to that. We have entered into this MOU a while ago in 2019, and this is the governance framework that we have in place. We've updated it, you know, to include really relevant, pertinent issues that affect the two institutions. This framework is not to say that we don't talk. Where there are issues, the relevant officials get involved. Where Mr. Mamadisi and I need to get involved, we then also get involved to try and unlock whatever challenge is currently facing us. Then, Chairperson, just in terms of the status of the public protector's report, I think Dr. Demane has indicated this. we have a legal opinion internally, which raised a number of factual and legal errors in terms of the report. There was no remedial action directed at SABS specifically. So in terms of an action that SABS is had to implement, there was none in the report that was directed at SABS. I think Dr. Demania has spoken to the challenges. We wanted to take this report on review. I think this is now prescribed. We have 6 months, as I understand it, after the report is published to take the report on review. So that option is no longer on the table. But there's been an MOU signed with the National Regulator of Compulsory Specifications. And I think the point that I'd just like to share with the committee is that I think the public protector has unfortunately presumed that SABS has policy tools at her disposal that we actually don't have. And so we haven't been able to execute or, you know, respond to the number of issues the public protector has raised because they are factually incorrect. We don't have those policy tools and it's not within our mandate. So, Chair, just the next couple of slides is around the questions that were raised in the PP's report around factual and legal errors. I think the first one is that they said that we didn't conduct adequate quality assurance tests. Now, each standard contains the kinds of tests that's required for a particular product. We would test according to that standard. If there are any other standards or any other tests that are required to be performed that's not within the standard, it is not the responsibility of the Bureau to do that. It is the responsibility of the regulator who would then say, these are additional tests that should be included, take this back into the technical committee and review that. And Chair, the NRCS has in fact done that already. They've identified a number of areas. They've put that work into the technical committee, and Edward Hall will chat to that shortly. So we were then contracted, as we are in a number of other institutions, because we have a commercial mandate as well, to conduct tests. So we test a product. The customer can also come to the Bureau and say, this is the standard, but I don't want you to test according to the full standard. I only need you to test pass 1, 2, and 5. We then would issue a test report based on the testing of pass 1, 2, and 5. We would not then issue a test report based on the standard in its entirety. The next one is that the public protector had indicated, relating to these tests, that SABS, they did not suggest that SABS carried out the test contrary to the applicable national standards. However, they did find that the tests were conducted on static vehicles and that they felt that there wasn't conclusive evidence on the status of these vehicles. Now, the standard itself would prescribe the test methods to be tested. So it would then say it would be on, and I think this was on the rollover test, it is done on a static vehicle and not on a moving vehicle, and that is contained within the national standard. And then I think I've already explained the process through which standards are developed. Where there's a need for that standard to be amended, a regulator can inform SABS that these are additional considerations. It's then taken up in the technical committee, and then it goes through this national consultative process. So, Chair, the next area is that they were saying that SABS had not conducted adequate quality assurance tests, and I think once again the adequacy of those tests is vested in the regulator. And then, Chair, the compulsory specification 80023 specifically provides that the evidence of compliance with the requirements of this compulsory specification would be recognized by the regulator if it's from a lab that forms part of an international or regional mutual acceptance scheme, a lab that is accredited to ISO or IEC 17025 by SANAS or an ILAC affiliated body, or a lab that has been successfully assessed against the requirements of 17025, and 17025 is the ISO standard, the international standards organization relating to labs, and how labs should be managed and run to the satisfaction of the regulator. So test reports for homologation purposes aren't just limited to those that are issued by SABS. The regulator can decide they want a range of other tests, and then, you know, those test reports could be sourced from a lab that meets the above criteria, as I've just indicated. SABS was a provided testing as a service provider, and it is not the responsibility of the Bureau to regulate compliance with regulatory requirements or the conversion of vehicles. And I'd spoken earlier about the tool set that SABS has at her disposal, as well then as the process of developing a national standard. The question that the Portfolio Committee on Transport raised with us was, how does SABS work alongside the NRCS? And I think I've indicated that. The NRCS as well, they are an independent third-party, they rely on independent third-party conformity assessment service providers like SABS or any other accredited facility. And that there's no exclusive relationship between SABS and the NRCS. They wanted to find out about the role that SABS played in the retrofitment process, and I think I've indicated it was limited to offering testing services. We received vehicle test samples from the South African Taxi Finance. They had then requested us to perform those tests, and that was the extent of the of our involvement in the matter. I must indicate that the test report that we have date back to 2009. So unfortunately, a lot of those colleagues have subsequently, you know, retired, resigned over time. And so we've had to look at what is available institutionally. There were questions about minimum requirements, and the customer can ask for specific tests to be performed. We would then issue a test report only on those specifics. So I think a key point to note is that the Bureau is not a regulator, and therefore it would be it's in the purview of the regulator to determine then whether that test report is sufficient, or whether those tests are sufficient, or whether any other tests should be required. Those are the two tests. We did the rollover detection with one on anchorage, and then the toll test as outlined in the National Road Traffic Act. A question was asked about when SABS learnt that Toyota condemned the conversion of panel vans for use as passenger carriers in the taxi industry. We are not able to determine that, unfortunately. But that doesn't have any bearing on the role that SABS played, because we don't have any legal authority to regulate the conversion of vehicles, and we wouldn't have also any power on making any decision whether or not to convert these vehicles into passenger carriers. The Department of Transport, they've indicated that the process of retrofitment didn't require the authorization from the original manufacturer, as the process of modifying second-hand vehicles is legal, and that's captured for in the Road Traffic Act. And I think, you know, without expressing any opinion, I think the view by the Department of Transport explains then why Toyota was not consulted. I think there were questions about the minimum safety specifications, and once again, SABS, it doesn't have the mandate to indicate these are the minimum safety specifications. the national standard would determine tests, materials, chemicals that would be used in the manufacture of that product, or specify which tests need to be done, where any other tests it would be outside of our mandate. Chair, I think this is fairly much the same. It's about safety specifications, and I don't want to belabor the point. It is outside of the mandate to issue minimum safety specifications for vehicle conversions, and we did not, in fact, issue any of those safety conversions. The safety specifications, I apologize, we tested the vehicles based on a specific standard. Chair, and I think we must note the point and make the point that I think the carnage on our roads as a result of this really weighs heavily on one as a South African citizen. And in the discussions we've had with the NRCS and the DCIC around this, I think we are fully cognizant of the impact of this. I think the challenge has been, you know, we can only do what is within the mandate of each of our institutions, and then see what we can fix, and then also be directed by the remedial action as indicated by the public protector in her report. Chair, very similar one about you know, the points the public protector made in her report, and that the Portfolio Committee on Transport also raised with us, they were saying, despite having these safety tests, vehicles are still involved in a lot more accidents. And so I think the point is that the regulator would then have to relook at what those safety tests are and how one would have to then include those additional tests within the national standards. And I think Mr. Mamadisi would talk to that, because that certainly has already been done. And then there were questions just about mitigation, you know, what could be done to mitigate these, and I think the NRCS would also talk to that. The last question was about a monitoring mechanism to ensure that this doesn't reoccur, and I think this is in the purview of the regulator. And certainly I think when we do get information from regulators, including the NRCS, into our technical committees, we then ensure that we really manage that process to develop or to amend that national standard that is within our time frames. So, Chair, I think those are the points I wanted to make. Thank you very much for the opportunity to share the presentation from the Bureau of Standards. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Scholes. Can I hand over to Mr. Mamadise from NRCS?
Thank you, Chair, and again, congratulations on your appointment. Let me start first with introducing the team. I'm assisted today by Duncan Mutengwe. He's doubling up as the acting COO as well as the head of automotive department. I'm also assisted by Deboha Apani, our head of legal, and Edward Matemba, head of strategy. I will start with the background. Chair, the thesis of my presentation would try to outline the factual basis with a view to assist the committee in getting all the relevant information as to what happened with the issue at hand, which is the illegal conversion of motor vehicles into taxis. Chair, the important thing that we want to emphasize is that vehicle conversions and modifications are allowed in terms of the law. They must follow a prescribed process as per legislation and the compulsory specification. The challenge, however, is that some of these conversions happen through the back door. They don't follow any approved process by the relevant entities, including ourselves and the DOT. There has been concerns generally from our engagement with the a subcommittee on transport about the conversions in general. So our view is that the policy department, which is the Department of Transport, has incorporated in the legislation the process for conversion of vehicles. If there is a change of view, the policy department would have to amend the legislation so that the NRCS can act accordingly in line with the legislation. In the case of the illegal panel vans, the NRCS became aware of the illegally converted panel vans in June 2008. I think I want to point out here that the NRCS was only established on 1 September 2008 as a separate entity. Before that, it was part of the SABS. So the problem, as it is stated by the PP, emanated and we inherited it as the NRCS upon our formation on 1 September 2008. But in terms of the legislation, of course, Chair, we take full responsibility for all the actions that were done by the regulatory division of the SABS at the time, and therefore we take full accountability for what had happened insofar as it pertained to the scope of the NRCS. In order to deal with the issue of illegally converted, illegal activities relating to import and export of motor vehicles, ITAC, which is the International Trade Administration Commission, commissioned a study group. We were part of those stakeholders, including SARS, SAPS, DOT, SIU, and the International Vehicle Identification Desk. Although the scope of this task team was to look at the issue of import and export of vehicles generally, it became apparent during the discussion in this task team that there is also another issue which relates to illegal conversion of panel vans into taxis. The task team then realized that it is not within their mandate, their original mandate, to look into the issue, and decided to establish a subcommittee to look specifically at the issue of modified taxis. At the time, the NRCS became aware that there were 2,353 illegally converted panel vans. Amongst other contributions that we have made as the NRCS during the work of the subcommittee, we realized that there is a loophole or lacuna in our law in terms of how the modification has been defined in the Road Traffic Act. We suggested to the subcommittee that the definition should be amended so that it can incorporate all vehicle modification, irrespective of whether of the use, whether it was going to be used as a long distance group touring or as a taxi. All modification should be treated as such. This is important in the context of the taxi recapitalization project that is at the center of the discussion today, Jay, because in terms of the TRP requirements, the the requirements are only applicable to minibus and midibus that are designed to carry passengers for reward. So this is obviously a challenge because most people will then submit vehicles for modification under the guise that these vehicles will not be used as taxis, but they will eventually find their way on the road and be used as taxis illegally. There were also other investigations that were conducted by SIU, the Vereeniging Licensing Office, and that investigation revealed that there is corruption in terms of registration of these vehicles. Some vehicles were registered without complete documents. Some were registered without an LOA or certificate of compliance from the NRCS, which is a huge challenge. Now, dealing with the NRCS mandate in the automotive space, as Dr. Dimana has alluded, we have been appointed as an inspectorate of manufacturers, importers, and builders of motor vehicles in terms of Section 7 of the National Road Traffic Act. Our scope and mandate in terms of the appointment, I must mention again, Chair, this is the appointment that we inherited from SABS, because it was the SABS that was appointed at a time before our formation. But with the split, we then carried forward this mandate as the NRCS. Our scope involves evaluating and recommending MIBs, applicants for registration with the DOT, inspection of the registered MIBs at least once a year. We recommend suspension and cancellation for MIBs who have been found wanting in terms of the law. We issue model numbers, commonly known as NATIS model numbers, to vehicles that meet the requirements. We issue a certificate of compliance for minibus and midibus models approved for reward. That will be your taxis in terms of the NLTA. We issue letter of authority for vehicles manufactured and imported or built for private use. That will be for individuals. For instance, if an individual imports a vehicle from anywhere else in the world, we will then stop that vehicle at the port of entry until we scrutinize the application and issue a letter of authority for the vehicle to enter South Africa. The approval process of motor vehicles in general, as Jody has also alluded, the NRCS enforces compulsory specification. The compulsory specification, VC8023, is the relevant specification that covers motor vehicles, categorized as M2 and M3 vehicles. In terms of the approval process, all motor vehicles that are covered by the VC shall be manufactured in accordance with the VC. MIBs shall have a vehicle model or any modification approved by NRCS prior to registration of that vehicle into the NATIS system. Approved motor vehicles shall be issued with homologation and or a compliance certificate or an LOA and NATIS model number, which allows that individual vehicle to be registered. So in other words, Chair, if to give you an example, if Toyota want to manufacture a Toyota Hilux, they will then submit a sample to us. We will scrutinize it with all the supporting documents, and if it meets the requirements, we will then issue the compliance certificate to Toyota together with Nati's model number to enable to produce Toyota Hilux of similar kind for the market. As I've alluded, the minibuses are covered under the VC8023, which specify minimum requirements for passenger carrying vehicles with a capacity of 9%, including the driver. They are commonly referred to as M2 and M3 vehicles. The question has been raised that what do we do to ensure continuous compliance by the original equipment manufacturers, the OEMs. We do that by conducting continuous market surveillance. We do have a market surveillance strategy in place which enable us to conduct inspections at the manufacturing plants, at the ports of entry, and the dealerships. Now, the status of the public protector report, Chair, I think I want to put the matters into perspective that the NRCS is still of the view that the public protector has failed dismally to comprehend the mandate of the NRCS and separate the roles of all the entities that are involved in the regulation of motor vehicles. But that is not to say, Chair, that we want to involve you as a court to review the public protector report. But what we want to do is to assist the committee with all relevant information to enable the committee to be able to fulfill their oversight role, having had all available facts on the table. So whatever we say and in relation to the public protector report, it's not asking you to act as a review court, but to enable you to have all relevant information that will enable you to perform your duties. That's why we say, Chair, that we have accepted in good faith some of the recommendations in the public protector report, and we are doing our utmost best to ensure that we improve on the process of the motor vehicle conversions and motor vehicle regulations in general. My colleagues have already said that we intended to take the PP report on review, but we decided against that for the reasons that have already been alluded to. Some of the reasons why we say we don't concur with the PP findings in the report, especially in terms of how the legal requirements or the scope of our work is concerned has been interpreted. The NRCS does not have a mandate and inspection power of vehicles operating on the public road. We are not a law enforcement entity, similar to RCMC, the municipalities, and the rest. In other words, it would be an anomaly for us to be standing on the road with our inspectors, stopping individual vehicles. It is not our mandate. We will be acting alter vires beyond the scope of our legal mandate. The NRCS mandate is to inspect vehicle at the source, which will be the MIBs, the dealership, and the points of entry, as I've alluded to earlier on. The registering authority should not allow any vehicle to be registered with without the NRCS approval. In other words, no vehicle should be registered with the provincial authorities without an LOA or certificate of compliance issued by the NRCS. It is the responsibility of the law enforcement authority to ensure that the vehicle that is being registered complies with the law. If it is a conversion, it is the responsibility of the law enforcement authority to ensure that the conversion has been approved in terms of the legal framework, including that they have been issued with a certificate of compliance by the NRCS. Vehicles operating on the public road must be dealt with in terms of Section 44, which deals with the safety of vehicles, Section 87, which deals with the notices that may be issued by relevant law enforcement officers, and Section 89, which deals with offences and penalties in terms of the NRTA. And these sections vest powers on the law enforcement authorities to impound or remove any vehicle from the road that is not compliant. It is not the mandate of the NRCS. As much as we have been appointed as the inspectorate for the MIBs, we have not been given these powers. These powers remain exclusively at the disposal of the law enforcement authorities. Our mandate ends with the issuance of the LOA or the compliance certificate, as well as the notice number for the specific model, and from there the registration process and ensuring that the vehicle continues to comply is the responsibility of the MIB, the DOT, the RTMC, and the law enforcement authorities. This implies that NRCS does not have access to any information pertaining to what happens to individual vehicles that a particular consumer has. In other ways, Chair, we would not know if the Honorable Chair purchased a panel van and at her backyard she decides to convert it into something else. We wouldn't know about that. But the road traffic enforcement officers will be able to have access to that information because they know the details of the vehicle, who purchased it, where do they reside, and that is beyond the scope of the NRCS. Now, dealing with the requirements for a new taxi vehicles under the taxi recapitalization program. In 2008, the National Department of Transport, as the policymaker, decided on the taxi recapitalization program in order to replace the existing taxis with the new taxi vehicles. The implementation date was 1 January 2008. It was applicable to 9 to 35-seater vehicles. It was not applicable for vehicles meant for private and touring vehicles. The new taxi vehicles enhance safety requirements in addition to the requirements of the compulsory specification. And those new requirements were gazetted in terms of notice R895 of September 2008. The additional requirements for new taxi vehicles were that the vehicles needed to have strength of seat and seat encouragements, prohibition of fold-up seats and middle seats, seat dimensions, and driver seat partitioning, sideway tilt, restraining devices, safety glass, emergency exits and entrance and exits, and passageways, side and rear reflective marking, and 100 kilometer per hour speed limit sticker. Notice of load, the vehicle needed to indicate how many passengers can be carried in that vehicle, and the rollover protection device, braking system, which was type 2 test. These were the additional requirements in terms of the TRP that the new taxi vehicles needed to comply with. The role of the NRCS in the registration process. The MIEB will manufacture, import, or modify a vehicle. It will ensure compliance with the relevant legislation. It will present a sample of the vehicle with supporting documents to the NRCS. NRCS will verify compliance of the sample vehicle and issue a compliance certificate and notice number for the model that has been specified. Now turning to the illegal panel van conversions. After we became aware as part of the task team that I've alluded to earlier on, Jay, we embarked on a 2-week blitz in order to gather information around the issue of illegally converted panel van. In that 2 weeks, we managed to visit, together with other entities, we managed to visit 43 dealerships, 11 registered MIBs, 2 unregistered MIBs, and 50 taxi rigs. And in total, we inspected about 212 vehicles. The findings in terms of the information gathering, we found that some of the registered builders for minibus category were found to be involved in illegal conversion of panel vans. Most dealerships were found to be in partnership with either registered or unregistered builders who were doing illegal conversions. Non-compliant Toyota Quantums which were converted were predominantly registered in our system as panel vans. Most converted Quantum panel vans could be registered without valid notice number. None of the registered builders converting Quantum panel vans were certified by NRCS, except for Toyota as an importer of Quantum minibus. Unregistered builders operating in backyards were also involved in the conversion, illegal conversion of panel vans. Due to these blitz that were conducted, and as well as the work that was done by the Department of Transport in KZN, we managed to delink one of the biggest converters of panel vans, which is Umkene Auto Trimmers. Our efforts to try to delink other MIBs like Taxi RS and Peterson Taxi World were met by legal challenges because of the issue that I've raised before in terms of the lacuna or loophole that was in the law at the time, where a person can then claim that the vehicle is not going to be used as a taxi, and it will bypass the requirements, the additional requirements of TRP in that sense. And in terms of the KZN, they have managed to withdraw the operating licenses for some of the non-compliant builders. Now, the implementation of the corrective action, Dr. Dimana has alluded that the policymaker, which is the Department of Transport, when they realize that there has been a challenge with the illegal conversion of panel vans, they decided to rectify those panel vans instead of removing them from the road. The department then approved the requirements in September 2009 that would be followed by the testing that was going to be done by SAPS and Geotech. The project to retrofit all these illegally converted taxis started on 1 March 2010. The TFM, which is one of the MIBs, was the MIB that was issued with approvals and two notice model numbers by the NRCS after they have complied with the requirements and submitted a sample to the NRCS to carry out the conversion or retrofitment of the illegally converted vehicles. The process that was agreed upon with the National Department of Transport and all the key stakeholders involved in the retrofitment process was that TFM will then do the modification. Once the modification or retrofitment has been completed, the NRCS will inspect the modified or corrected taxi, then issue a letter of authority. Each owner had the responsibility to conduct the DOT and ensure that the vehicle is delivered to TFM for retrofitment. NRCS will then be called upon to inspect the vehicle and issue the LOA for a specific vehicle. By the end of 2014, only 348 vehicles were issued with the LOA, which means that about 2,005 vehicles remain on the road, as Dr. Dimana has alluded, and they have not been corrected in terms of the process that was outlined by the DOT. Now, turning to the public protector findings, the main finding against the NRCS is that the NRCS failed to take effective and efficient measures to ensure that all MIBs comply with the compulsory specification as envisaged by the NRCS Act in order to restrict the illegal conversion of goods carrying Toyota Quantum panel vans into taxis for reward. Our response as the NRCS, which must be taken in the context that I've alluded to earlier on, that it is not to embarrass or attack the public protector, but is to place correct facts before the committee to enable it to do its work. The NRCS does not agree with the finding. The reason for that is that the NRCS has a market surveillance strategy, which it is implementing to regulate the MLBs. The focus is on high-risk areas in a bid to ensure that we maximize our resources. NRCS, on average, conduct 1,300 MIBs inspections annually to ensure compliance with the compulsory specification. However, that will not eliminate the problem of unscrupulous MIBs who do illegal conversion, because we cannot have the residence inspectors at all MIBs, and we cannot have resident inspectors at every individual's house to ensure that individuals don't do any illegal conversions on their cars. When non-compliance is identified, the NLCS will act decisively as a regulator, as we have done with the Umgeni auto trimmers. The one of the issues that is raised by the public protector to support her finding is that a letter of authorization from Toyota was not obtained. But this finding, Chair, ignores the fact that there is no legal requirement for a letter of authorization by the OEM. That is so in terms of the NLTA as well as the regulations that were issued by the Department of Transport. While we acknowledge that SANS 10267 requires a letter of authorization, that standard has not been called upon in our regulations or by any other regulations or legislation. Therefore, it remains a voluntary standard. We didn't have to comply with it at the time. In this case, the NRCS followed the approved retrofitment requirements that were approved by the Department of Transport. As I've alluded to, the process involved identifying critical parts and system of vehicles that were needed to be adhered to in terms of the TRT requirements. The vehicle were then tested by SABS and the Geotech, as I've alluded to, and the TFM will do the conversions or retrofitment, and NRCS will only issue an LOA after it is certified that the retrofitment has been done in line with the requirements of the TRP. Another second issue that the public protector uses to support the finding is that the NRCS failed to identify 1,986 vehicles, although it is empowered in terms of Section 17 of the NRCS Act. But this finding, Chair, again ignores the fact that the Act that she refers to only came into effect on 1 September 2008, and therefore the NRCS could not have invoked a legislation that was not yet in operation at the time the issue of panel vans, illegal conversion of panel vans, arose, and even before the NRCS itself was established as a separate entity in terms of that legislation. As we have already indicated, the illegal converted panel vans were already identified in June 2008, even before the Act came into effect, even before the NRCS was established as a separate entity. Again, we want to reiterate, Chair, that the NRCS does not have a mandate nor inspection powers on vehicles that have been sold to individuals for registration process. Continuous compliance of those vehicles can only be done at the point of registration by the licensing authorities under the DOT and the RTMC and the provincial departments. NRCS could not have detected that this vehicle, since it is not a registering authority of motor vehicles. By a simple analogy, Chair, the example that I've given you, that only the registering authority will know who is the owner of which vehicle, and who is the where do they reside, and what vehicle, whether the vehicle is fit for the road or is continuing to comply with the legislation. Therefore, NRCS could not invoke Section 17 to deal with these vehicles that were operating illegally on the road, because those vehicles could only be dealt with in terms of the relevant section of the National Road Traffic Act, which empowers certain law enforcement authorities to do that. I think we have reiterated the point a lot, Chair. I will move to the next point. The third issue that the public protector emphasized is the impact of these illegally converted panel vans into minibus taxis. As I have already alluded, NRCS has no control over individual vehicle registration process. The illegally converted panel vans into minibus taxis were illegally registered through the licensing authorities without any approval from the NRCS. It is important to note, Chair, that these illegally converted panel vans, they are still registered on our system, on the NATI system, as panel vans, which is evidence enough to show that the registration of those vehicles would have happened under suspicious circumstances or fraudulent circumstances. Our only recommendation is that those remaining illegally converted panel vans be deregistered or be impounded by the authorized entities from the road exercising their powers in terms of the legislation. In terms of the remedial action is that the Minister of the DTIC must take urgent and effective steps to harness and foster good, effective and efficient working relationship between NRCS and SAPS, except to point out that the remedial action, as alluded by the PP, is disconnected from the findings that have been made against the NRCS. However, the NRCS has proactively concluded an MOU with SAPS in October 2019. We have reviewed that MOU recently, Chair, to take into consideration some of the challenges that have been identified by the PP in her report. The MOU is a framework under which the parties mutually interact to improve the working relationship and are able to collaborate with each other on matters of mutual interest. We also concluded another MOU with DOT, as Dr. Dimana has alluded, in August 2021. The MOU strengthened the relationship between us and DOT, also helped us to define the roles and responsibility of each party, because we are all collectively involved in the regulation of the motor vehicles as through the compulsory specification and the delegated mandate that we have received from DOT. The MOU also created a platform for discussion on matters relating to vehicles, especially the tax recapitalization in South Africa regarding the determination of the taxi age limit requirements, which is a discussion that we have already started with the DOT and other stakeholders. In implementing some of the recommendations of the PP Chair, the NRCS established a task team, a dedicated task team of inspectors to inspect all registered MIBs, especially those have been involved in converting goods carrying vehicles into passenger carrying vehicles in order to ensure continuous compliance, also enforce compliance with legislation where we have identified non-compliance. The focus of the task team has been to look at the issues of complaints handling, investigation of alleged non-compliance of vehicles, investigation on misuse of NATIS model numbers, the ongoing audit of all the registered MIBs, all registered bodybuilders of motor vehicles have been categorized into small, medium, and large companies using our risk-based approach. 100 high-risk MIBs have been identified and have been inspected by the end of the last financial year. The preliminary outcomes of that investigation reveal that there are no active companies that are conducting illegal conversion of minibus vehicles. The NRCS, as part of its market surveillance strategy, continues to inspect MIBs, taking into account the loopholes that have been identified by the public protector, as well as the risk associated with each individual MIB, to ensure continuous compliance. Phase two of the investigation will be concluded by the end of this month. I may just highlight that we already have a draft report produced by the task team, and we are on track to finalize same. And if necessary, we'll be able to share that with the DTIC and the DOT. The NRCS is addressing some of the loopholes in the modification of the motor vehicles. In general, and despite the fact that we have highlighted that the PP got it wrong when she raised the issue of letter of support by the OEM, in terms of our new requirements, we ensure that the supporting documents by original equipment manufacturer is part of the requirements, so that the second tier vehicle approval can be done. In other words, the letter of authority by the original OEM is a requirement. That will eliminate the issue of vehicles being converted without the approval of the original owner of that vehicle. The NRCS made a proposal to the SABS Technical Committee to review and amend SANS 10319, which deals with the registration process of MIBs, so that we can enhance continuous monitoring and compliance of the MIBs. Our intention is that once that standard has been approved, we will then reference it in the regulations as part of the compulsory specification. The NRCS has initiated a project the Save Aviators 2025, which aim to align all motor vehicle regulations to the developments around the world, first through our participation in the WP29, to incorporate issues of self-driving cars, electrical vehicles, and so forth, and also to deal with some of the findings that have been identified by the public protector, as well as the issues that happened previously with fires on motor vehicles. National the Department of Transport and other stakeholders have been identified, and they are part of that vehicle Safer Vehicle 2025 project, and we have received enormous support from all the stakeholders, including NAMSA. The recommendations by the NRCS to ensure that this issue does not recur in future, and to deal with the remaining vehicles, the National Department of Transport need to admin mark the remaining illegal panel vans, which we have identified as 2005, on the NACHIS system, and so that those vehicles cannot continue to operate on the road, because they will not be able to obtain any registration if they are admin marked. We also recommend that the requirements for all vehicle modifications should be reviewed, so that we can deal with holistically with all the vehicle conversions, including the conversion of taxis, ambulances, and trucks into buses. Standardization of vehicle modification, irrespective of use, to eliminate the loophole where people convert vehicles under the guise that the vehicle is not intended to be used as a taxi. Review of the legislation to articulate clearly the responsibility of each entity. Review of legislation to address the cross-cutting mandates. That's the end of the presentation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mamadife. Mr. Hannibal, does that include our presentations from all entities? You don't have any?
Yes,
okay, so I'll take discussion now, and then you can come afterwards to respond.
Thanks very much, Jay.
Okay. Portfolio committee members, can I take hands for discussion on the presentation by DTIC, NRCS, and SABS? Can I see hands, please, members?
Mr. Mbuyana, Chair, and Ms. Mwatse has raised their hands.
Okay, we'll start with Honourable Mbuyana.
Chairperson, thank you very much for the opportunity. Let me first welcome all the presentation made. And also, I'm having a comment, Chair, with regard to the DTIC. Chair, it will be appropriate to engage the lack of understanding of the public protector on the role of SABS and also the NRCS, as they did not take the report to review. And when they had a chance to do so. In other words, Chairperson, whether the report and its recommendation are flawed, it's neither there nor there. My clarification question is that as things stand, the findings and remedial of action as the public protector are binding on the entities. What remedial actions or implementation of the program are they engaging to moving forward? Because now we cannot elaborate on the issue that just raised to say the public protector this and the public protector that, because that matter was not taken on review. So if not being taken on review, what is it that we do in moving forward as a DTIC? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mbuyane. Honorable Burns, no Mashe.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And my question that I have, firstly, Chair, we must appreciate the presentations that have been made by the entities, but also, Chair, make a special plea or request that in future, when they make presentations, it is helpful not to use abbreviations almost all the time. Yes, I can understand that it is the sector they are used to, but for instance, from time to time, this committee would have new members, and those members must not find themselves lost in the process of the presentation. So I will just make that a request. Coming now to the questions, Chair. Yes, we can see, Chair, that, for instance, there seems to be an MOU spoken about between the Bureau of Standards as well as the regulatory body. But, Chair, MOUs generally without practical programs embarked upon do not really yield a positive result. By their own definition, it's about a memorandum of understanding. So we understand that we are entering into this relationship. But the issue is about what are these entities practically and really doing about that which they have agreed to enter into a cooperation relationship. So in view of that, Chair, I would be interested to know as to the mutually reinforcing measures that have been implemented between the Bureau of Standards as well as the regulatory body, you know, besides the MOUs, you know, in practical terms, because at the end of the day, Chair, this is about ensuring quality standards that give a reasonable comfort in terms of issues of safety and all of that, given the challenges that we have, especially the carnages in our roads. So it's going to be important to have a sense of those practicalities. And the second question, Chair, we would also want to get a sense as to the practical measures that the department and the entities adopted to improve and update, you know, the specifications for the automotive industry, and also measures to cap those that are done through unconventional means. You know, there's a term, Chair, which I don't really agree to, which I don't really like, when we talk about illicit practices within a particular industry. It will always be referred to as you know, the black business, or you know, it's referred to as something that is black. Yet the masterminds behind those, in most cases, are always referred to as white collar crime. You know, the master is there sitting, manipulating all the processes in cozy offices, and the other people are doing the dirty job. So we need to know exactly what is it that the department is doing also to ensure that these conditions to have this kind of practices, you know, those conditions are actually put to zero. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Now to our brand new member to this committee, Honorable Chris Malimacha.
Thank you, Chair. Let me take this opportunity to also join the choir and congratulate you on the new responsibility. Members, also join the choir to welcome the presentation. We must time and again bear in mind that whatever we are doing in a form of employment or given responsibility, life. I'm saying this because the two entities, when they speak, they must never try to speak as if they operate differently from different countries. They must work jointly to ensure that we save lives. Here, when we talk of this industry that carries passengers on daily basis, in each and every year we are given the stats of many people died. However, Chair, I was just raising that somewhere it touches that some other things has to take long to come and be corrected. I have three questions, Chairperson, with your allowance, that will be directly to start. Number one will be, comrades, has SAR considered rendering conformity assessment service in order to improve the effectiveness of the two entities? Number two, from the Chairperson, from the vehicle sample test made by the SAT of illegally converted vans, was SAT not able to pick up the safety risk and possible non-compliance with safety standards, notwithstanding the fact that SAT is not a regulator? We are very aware that SAT is not a regulator, but the AVAP itself caused a lot of questions, comrades. Number three, noting that SAT does not set safety specifications. However, it would appear that there is a direct correlation between testing vehicles for national standards and vehicle safety standards. How does SAT ensure that after testing vehicles that these safety standards are implemented? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Malimacha, Honorable Moatse.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, for the opportunity. I've got a few questions on the NRCS. First question was, what measures has been adopted by the NRCS to oversee the consistent compliance of the MIBs with the necessary specifications? And also, what measures has the NRCS taken into improve its surveillance strategy to combat non-compliance? If any, what sanctions or penalties were imposed in this regard? Lastly, Chairperson, what measures are in place to improve the responsiveness of the NRCS to concerns of non-compliance? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Moatse. Are there any further questions before I hand over to the entities and the department to respond to the issues raised by members?
No hands, Chair.
No hands. Okay. Can I then hand over to the team? Can I think let's take SABS first?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think Honourable Burns and Gawashe, thank you very much for the point. It is duly noted, and apologies that we've included all these acronyms, and I think you're absolutely right. We become so used to working using these acronyms that one just assumes that it's a normal discourse. So thank you very much for highlighting that. I think the, and I'm sure Edward will also talk to this, the MOU is the governing, it's a governance framework. There are lots of meetings. SABS tests, for instance, we test fish products at our lab in Cape Town. There's regular weekly meetings. There's lots of interaction at the technical level, at the lab level, between the NRCS and SABS relating to the test reports or to the testing and the subsequent test reports that we put out for the NRCS. So where there are issues, there may have been, the colleagues aren't able to resolve them. Edward and I meet and we resolve them. So it's a very practical arrangement. The governance structure, the MOU, is just to guide the process, but they are very practical lab-specific interactions that happen on a daily and a weekly and a monthly basis. I think Edward will talk to the measures that they've put in place to improve the specifications. Once we get those, we've been able to reduce the number of days it takes to publish a national standard. It used to be over 400. We're just under 300 right now, and we have a very close monitoring arrangement on any technical committee that we feel it's taking a bit too long to get the standard out, to get the work out. So, those are monitored weekly and we report on those quarterly to the DTIC as well. The conformity assessment services, SABS provides, thank you very much, Honorable Malimache, for your question. SABS does provide conformity assessment services to a number of players, including the NRCS, and that would then be governed by a service level agreement in terms of turnaround times that we would offer them. I'm not sure if I understood your question correctly. Please let me know if I haven't. Then I think the question that you raised about picking up the safety risk, we have experts in terms of testing and test methodologies. The experts in terms of sector-specific work reside in our technical committees, and those are on a voluntary basis where they come in and help us develop the national standard. So we wouldn't know in the labs whether that test would be sufficient, or if there are other tests available necessarily, we could consult with the technical committees to then identify that. But the technical committees, they would put in the standard or amend the standard to say, you know what, this standard needs to be beefed up, and that's what Edward has indicated they've done. They've written to us to say these standards need to be reviewed with these specific elements. Please look into this and start that process. So that process is definitely ongoing. Then I think the point that you're making about the implementation of standards and more broadly about how do we raise awareness for our standards, I think that is an area that we're working hard at. We're not quite there yet, and so that definitely is work in progress. We do raise awareness through webinars, publications, engagements. We've had an extensive engagement with a number of industry associations, companies. Industry associations invite us to talk to their members, and so we do have an awareness drive to talk about standards and how standards can and should be implemented, and also the importance of standards and how it supports trade and economic development. So there is some work, Honorable Malamache, but I think we do still have quite a bit of way to go in terms of creating that awareness. We've got some plans in place. We're trying to get that. Minister Patel convened a meeting with all of the entities earlier this week. He's given us strategic direction in terms of where we should be going. And so we are working right now to respond to that. And one of the things he did raise was around, you know, awareness of standards. So that is certainly something that we'll be giving a lot more attention to in the coming financial year. Chair, I think those were the questions directed at me. I'll pause, and if there's anything else, I'll take further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Scholes. Mr. Mamadise, for in RCS.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honourable Members, for the questions. I think let me just comment on the issue raised by Honorable Mbuyane that it will be difficult to engage on the submissions against the public protector while we have failed to review the report. Indeed, it is so that public protector report is binding and the remedial action is binding until it's set aside by a court of law. So I think it should be taken in that context that as the entity, particularly as the NRCS, we are implementing all the recommendations of the public protector report, and despite the fact that we have some concerns, the reason why we are putting those concerns before you is just that you need to have full information so that you separate facts from fiction. In terms of the questions by Honorable Benz Mamashe, in our presentation we included the list of all abbreviations in slide 35 to assist the Honorable Members to understand the acronyms that we are using. However, we take your concern into consideration in the future presentations. On the issue of MOU with SAPS, indeed, it would be naive of us to say that because we have an MOU, all is good. We have a nice thing. It's not a nice thing to have. But the key thing is that the MOU create a platform for engagements between ourselves and SAPS on matters of mutual interest and areas of collaboration. We do have a STECOM that is set up in terms of that MOU, where it allows us to engage on various issues, including testing, standards development, conformity assessment, and the labs, as you know, we are also sharing facilities with SAPS. We're also able to engage on issues of facilities and the situation of our own labs within the facilities that we are occupying in SABS. So I think Ms. Scholes has alluded to the fact that we are able to recommend some of the changes to the standards development that SAPS is administering through the work of the STEERCOM and our participation in some of the SABS committees dealing with standard development. So a lot of work is happening. I might add that in addition to the MOU, we have identified a need to have SLAs that will talk to these specific issues that I have alluded to in terms of the strengthening and collaboration between ourselves and SAPS in the interest of the South African public. In terms of the VC improvement, as I've alluded to, we have identified a project 2025, which is aimed at updating and reviewing all vehicle regulations. We have completed the light passenger and good vehicles technical requirements, but I must highlight that the process for the review of regulations is a lengthy process because it involves, it's similar to how you develop a legislation more or less. It involves stakeholder consultations, publication of the VC for public comments. Once we have public comments, we also need to respond to those public comments and then submit a final VC for consideration by the DTIC. So they, on average, that process may take up to a year, depending on the various factors in the process. What measures have we taken to address the issues that have been highlighted by the PP? I must highlight the fact that we can only take measures that fall within our mandate and our legal scope, because the NRCS is a creature of statutes, and we can only do so much in terms of the empowering legislation. I think I've highlighted most of the measures that we have already taken to implement the public protector report, including the fact that we have conducted established a task team to look in at all the issues and the gaps that have been raised by the public protector in our processes to ensure that we continuously improve in terms of how we regulate the MIBs. And some of the recommendations will be coming out of the report once it's finalized, so that we can recommend either to the DTIC or through our internal process how we can improve upon the measures that are in place. I think those are the relevant the questions from Honorable Mwatse. I almost forgot about those. What measures to oversee consistent compliance? There are two ways, as we have alluded, to ensure compliance with the compulsory specification. The first is the approval process, where all the manufacturers and builders of vehicles will apply for approval by submitting a sample to us, as well as supporting documents to ensure that the vehicle that is seeking approval for is in line with the legislation, in compliance with the compulsory specification. If we are satisfied that it does, we will then issue a letter of approval or a compliance certificate together with NACHIS number. The second tier of ensuring consistent and continuous compliance is through our market surveillance strategy, which is supported by our risk-based approach, in terms of which we are able to identify high-risk MIBs and ensure that they are visited by our inspectors on a continuous basis to ensure compliance with compulsory specification. And one of the recommendations that is coming out of the work that we are doing in implementing the public protector's report is the issue of introducing conformity of production for vehicles. That means that although the MIB will be submitting a sample for us, they need to ensure that all other vehicles that they are going to produce similar to the sample that they have submitted to us continue to meet the requirements of the specification throughout the process of the production. If there is anything wrong happening, we are able to intervene through the scope of the continuous conformity of production requirements. How do we improve on market surveillance inspection and implement sanctions? As I've indicated, Chair, we have in the recent years introduced a risk-based approach, which helps us to improve on our inspection in terms of dedicating the resources where they are required the most and focusing on the high-risk manufacturers and builders of motor vehicles in this case. Whenever we find non-compliances, we have been empowered in terms of Section 15 of our own Act to issue directives for any kind of non-compliance. The actions may include retaining whatever product to the country of origin. It may include confiscating the product. It may include destruction of the product depending on the circumstance of each case, or we may deal with it as we deem fit in terms of our own processes. But in relation specifically to the MIBs, the only power that we have is in terms of Section 7 is to recommend the deregistration of that MIB if the are found to be non-compliant with the legislation, as we have done with the Omogeni auto trimmers that I've alluded to during my presentation. The concerns of non-compliances, we have processes that help us to manage any concerns, including the concerns that have been highlighted by the public protector. One way of doing that is to register the complaint and then allocate the complaint to a specific unit. If it is relating to automotive, the head of the automotive will be in charge of that particular complaint and ensure that the complaint is investigated and feedback is provided. But in relation to the PP's concerns, as it in this case, we have taken a step further to establish a task team to look at comprehensively at the vehicle conversions in general and to look at the risk factors pertaining to the work that is being done by the MIBs. And I think it is important that we await the outcomes of that report so that we can be able to improve further in terms of our internal processes. I don't know, Chair, if one of my colleagues would want to add on what I have just said. Duncan, do you want to add?
Yeah, just before we bring Duncan on board, I see Honourable Motaung's hand is up. Honourable Motaung, if your questions have not been covered by the responses so far, I'll give you this opportunity to raise your discussion points. Honourable Motaung.
Thanks, Chair, for the opportunity. Only questions. One, the 1,300 annual MB inspection, how many of these have been found to be non-compliant? And secondly, how does the team of inspectors conduct surveillance on MIBs, particularly those involved in converting carrying vehicle into passengers carrying vehicles? Lastly, what practical efforts are in with the various relevant stakeholders to identify or to detect vehicles that are non-compliant and to avert a continuation of the same problem? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Motaung. Mr. Mutingwe, is there anything you want to add?
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and good morning to everyone. Perhaps what I could just add is to respond to the question from Honourable Mwate with regards to the improvements, with regards to the responsiveness of the NRCS, particularly the automotive department. So I think the report of the public protector has actually made us to be agile enough in terms of dealing with issues that are happening out in the market. So accordingly, we established a task team, in the sense that we formulated a unit within the automotive department that handles queries that are coming to the department, concerns which would be perhaps an ordinary citizen complaining about the vehicles that they might have bought and finding them to be perhaps not being safe. We will take that and we investigate that. And also any other complaint that might be aligned directly to the automotive business unit. So we have done that because of we have realized that when such things are raised and they are not attended to, we end up sometimes going to find ourselves in the media for us not actually doing our work. So we have actually a responsive team that deals with such matters. Perhaps also maybe to take the question from Honorable Mutaung with regards to the number of non-compliances that were identified for the 1,300 companies that we have inspected. I think it's proper just to clarify the fact that that was just an average of how many MIBs are we able to inspect on an annual basis when we look at our stats from the previous financial years. So it is very much dependent on the resources that we have, that we are able to, can only deal with 1,300. At this point in time, we cannot really quantify the number of non-compliances over a particular period, but we can highlight the fact that the non-compliances that we normally identify would be issues of non-adherence to the originally approved vehicle. In the main, it would be particularly in the trailer manufacturing industries. It will be also in the other components that support the vehicle manufacturing processes. But what we'll do is, as the CEO has already alluded, invoke Section 15 of the NRCS Act, or would, if it is a motor vehicle, invoke Regulation 44 of the National Road Traffic Act, where we can then de-link that particular model that is affected by the non-compliances, so that such a manufacturer, importer, or a builder will not be able to register further vehicles in that regard. I must really say that there's been quite a lot of work that is being done also in the trailer manufacturing industry, because that is where the majority of the non-compliances have been found. Thank you, Chair, and I think perhaps maybe the CEO can deal with the other questions.
CEO, do you want to come back?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I think the only question that we left is the practical steps with the that we are taking with the stakeholders. I think some of the practical steps that we are taking is in terms of the MOU that we have with the Department of Transport, which forms the platform to engage on all the issues that we identify through our inspection work of the MIBs. And we also able to highlight some of our findings and process improvement that we would recommend in terms of the legislation pertaining to vehicle regulation in general. I think that's the only thing that I would want to add. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Can I just check with Mr. Hannibal if there's any concluding remarks?
Thanks very much, Honourable Chair. Maybe just very briefly to agree with Honourable Mbuyane around the Public Protector's report. We do accept that, and I think that is reflected in the extent to which the entities and the DTIC today have tried to focus on the implementation of the remedial actions that the Public Protector indicated we need to implement. Just a second point that perhaps responds to Honourable Burns Namashe's question around essentially the illicit economy and what conditions are in place to prevent this kind of thing happening again. So, Chair, I think it's fair to say that we have tightened up the tools that we have available quite significantly. It's never the case that we can say that this will never ever happen again, but it will certainly be much more difficult in the sense of we've got much stronger surveillance, we've got tightening of the standards, and the two institutions have talked about that. But Chair, I think it is probably worth flagging that I don't think any of us can really rest easy at night until the 1,700-odd illegally converted panel vans are off our roads. And so it may well be that perhaps the committee would want to note that enforcement remains a bit of a challenge, and that the department will, of course, continue to work with the agencies and the other national departments like DOT to try and strengthen enforcement and to make sure that those illegally converted panel vans are taken off the road. So I think that might be an additional area. And then, of course, it would be ideal if there was consequence management for some of the licensing officials that in the Public Protector's report seems to have allowed licensing of the vehicles as taxis when, in fact, they should not have. But I think that's all from our side, Chair. We certainly have taken this the report seriously, and the remedial actions that have been put in place, we think will go a long way to ensuring that we don't have a repeat of what we saw in 2009. Thanks very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hannibal, and to your team and the teams from the entities who have reported to us today. I think in concluding our discussion today, the purpose, as we said at the beginning, was to check the implementation of the action plans that the remedial actions that were set by the Public Protector in a report. So what I want to, in conclusion, ask is that because we've received a presentation from the department, we've received a presentation from NRCS and SABS, that we get a document that sets out the action plans that have been submitted to the public protector, so that we then, in doing our oversight and drawing up our report, have a clear picture of how those action plans have been implemented, because we've received various presentations from you, if that can be arranged. I don't know if that would come from the department, Mr. Hannibal, whether you'd be able to do that.
Yes, Chairperson, I think it would be appropriate that DTIC incorporates the inputs from SABS and NRCS and then provides a comprehensive report to the committee. We can certainly do that, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. So that concludes our deliberations for today, and thank you all for your attendance. Enjoy the rest of your day, and I hope the budget the budget speech today doesn't burst any bubbles. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Chair, before we conclude, in terms of your request that you made to the DTIC in regarding the submission of that report, can we determine a time frame, because we are required to do as a committee a report on the matter? So it will be good if you indicate to the DTIC when they should submit that report so that we can start proceedings in terms of our committee obligations with respect to the report.
Maybe you can give us an indication, Secretary, what would be a reasonable time frame to set?
I think within a week, if we can receive the reports from the DTIC, then that will assist us in starting our processes, Chair. That will be, if the DTIC is funded, Chair.
Thank you very much. So within 7 days, Mr. Hannibal, if we can receive that report so that we can conclude our reporting on this matter. Thank you very much. In closing the meeting, Committee Secretary, if you can just announce our next meeting or any other further announcements you wish to make.
Chair, our next meeting is next week, Tuesday, the 1st of March. We will receive a briefing by the DTIC on the 2020-21 annual incentive report, Chair. That is scheduled for the 1st of March, and the 2nd of March, we will receive a briefing by the SIU on the status of its investigation into allegations of corruption at the National Lotteries Commission, Chair. Those are the two meetings scheduled for next week.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, and thank you to all members and all, everybody else on the platform. The meeting stands adjourned.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair.